I just wanted to jump into Jeremiah. We're going to bring the conclusion of the matter. Jeremiah, the conclusion of the matter. So we are going to jump to the very last chapter of the book, chapter 52. You know, in the Lord of the Rings trilogy, 3 4-hour films. You can imagine when it came to the conclusion of 12 hours of a movie, how do you bring a conclusion to that? And as a Lord of the Rings fan, I was very wondering, how are they going to do this? And as it turned out, they had 5 conclusions. The film just kept going to black, and everybody's like, oh, that was so good. And then it would come back on again, and there was another conclusion, and it kind of faded to black, and it came back on again. And some of the people who obviously aren't fans were going, oh, come on. He's like, just end the film already, right? It's sometimes difficult to wrap things up. It's sometimes take a whole bunch of stuff and bring some kind of conclusion to it to close it off. And I feel a little bit like that with Jeremiah. Jeremiah having to take all of a whole lifetime of ministry, and they compile his sermons, they compile his messages and the activities that happen, and then you have to bring some kind of conclusion to what the life of Jeremiah was about in his ministry. You have to sort of wrap it up and say, okay, here's the book reflecting Jeremiah's ministry, and how do we conclude this? What are the final words? And so they came up with some final words. Now, before I read them to you, let me just remind you of the historical facts of what happened here. Because you saw it a little bit in the intro 2 months ago when we started this. And I'll just highlight and remind you again a little bit what happened. The whole time, Jeremiah starts ministering during the reign of a king named Josiah. And Josiah was a child when he became king, and he did a lot of reforms and was a great king in Israel and did a lot of great things in Israel for the 31 years that he was on the throne. And toward the end of his time, Jeremiah comes on board, becomes this public figure. He's a public, well-known teacher. You would think in terms today of some of the personalities on TV in the Christian community, you see Jeremiah would be like that. People know of this guy. And when Josiah died, Jeremiah wrote a series of laments and put them together into a book to reflect about this king. And they were shared around the whole country. So Jeremiah becomes quite famous at the end of Josiah's life by the writings and the laments and the poetry that he brought forth to mark that occasion. So he's well known. Then the new king comes on board. It's Josiah's son. 3 months into his reign, he gets kidnapped and taken to Egypt. And his uncle ends up being put on the throne. And while he gets on the throne, there's a lot of prosperity in the nation. There's a lot of things going well. But there's this looming threat of other things. And then there's Jeremiah saying to the people, I know we've had a great king. I know we've had a good time. And things have been great. But you still have to be obedient to God. And you're not being obedient to God. And in fact, I'm going to tell you, because even with a good king, even when things are going well, you're just not getting it. God is going to bring down a very serious, the most serious judgment you've had yet. He's bringing Nebuchadnezzar. He's bringing the Babylonians. And they are going to destroy this country. They are going to wipe it out. They're going to wipe out the city, wipe out the temple. And that's what he went around saying. He became quickly very unpopular. He quickly became a guy that leaders hated, that people didn't want to have around. They did whatever they could to get rid of him. They threw him in a cistern and tried to just let him die and rot in a muddy, just big cave in the hole in the ground. He faced all kinds of persecution, but he consistently said, you need to pay attention because God is going to do something serious if you don't listen. And as his ministry went around, it kind of changed to, you're clearly not listening and you're not going to listen, therefore there's no more option. It's happening. You will be wiped out. So then in 605, another king comes on board. He's on for a number of years. And Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, comes into the country, wipes out an area. He camps around, he sieges the city, or basically conquers them. He doesn't destroy Jerusalem or anything at this point. He just conquers them and makes them pay tribute. Takes away the king, puts another king in place and says, you're going to be the king and you're going to pay taxes to me. And then he goes back, he takes Daniel. He takes the three Hebrew children, he takes a whole bunch of officials, and he goes back to Babylon. And then the king, whose name is Zedekiah, decides, you know, I don't think I need to pay taxes. I don't think that Babylon's going to keep being strong. In fact, Egypt is doing pretty good. I think we're going to be okay. We don't need to worry about Nebuchadnezzar anymore. I'm going to stop paying taxes. We got Egypt. They're going to help us. And we're gonna be okay. And Jeremiah the whole time is saying, no, you're not. No, you're not. No, you're not. Egypt is not going to help you. This is not going to work. You think that you got it okay, and it's not. You need one thing, to listen to God. And the people don't. So Nebuchadnezzar comes back again, and he attacks again. And there's this sieges. For 2.5 years, the city is circled by his armies. And it gets to the point where they're starving to death. Like there's no food. It's a horrible, horrible war. It's a horrible situation. Jerusalem is at the lowest point in its history. From the heights of David and Solomon to the lowest point now of Zedekiah, who ends up being captured, killed, and then Nebuchadnezzar decides, you know what, I don't even want this city around anymore. He tears the temple in pieces. He takes the wall. They toss every stone off the wall. They decimate the city. And then they take even more people off into captivity. Many of the people fled to Egypt. They thought Egypt will save us. We'll flee there. Nebuchadnezzar destroys Egypt. Nothing works out for them. Jeremiah tries to tell them, don't do it. They capture Jeremiah, and they actually kidnap him and take him with them to Egypt. They don't give him a choice. They just take him with them. And the story ends very, very poorly. Them never listening, and then God bringing about this great destruction. With no uncertainty, I want you to know, though, that the entire message of Jeremiah can be wrapped up in the words, God wins. Okay? God does what he says he'll do. And he can do it. And he will do it. Don't ever mistake it. Like, if there's one thing just in summary of Jeremiah, is you better know that God is able and he will win. He gets the last word. All the kinds of illustrations you want to use, he gets the last word. So here's what we see in the closing statements. Starting in verse, I have no PowerPoint, by the way. Too many technology problems this weekend. We just said drop. So it says, starting verse 27. So Judah went into captivity away from her land. And this is the number of the people Nebuchadnezzar carried into exile. In the seventh year, 3,023 Jews. In Nebuchadnezzar's 18th year, 832 people from Jerusalem. In his 23rd year, 745 Jews taken into exile by Nebuzaradan, the commander of the imperial guard. There were 4,600 people in all. And then it goes on and says, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, so one of the previous kings who had been taken off into captivity by Babylon, is in prison in Babylon. And it says, in the 37th year of the exile of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, in the year Marduk became king of Babylon, on the 25th day of the 12th month, he released Jehoiakim, king of Judah, and freed him from prison. He spoke kindly to him and gave him a seat of honor, higher than those of the other kings who were with him in Babylon. So Jehoiakim put aside his prison clothes and for the rest of his life ate regularly at the king's table. Day by day, the king of Babylon gave Jehoiakim a regular allowance as long as he lived till the day of his death. We always read stories like Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and we forget sometimes, but they overlap with this. Daniel actually would have been connected to Jehoiakim. They would have known each other. He was in the palace and high official at the same time. You know, so this is all around that same time period. But here, in the end of the story, we see mercy. We see mercy being extended. We see God changing the hearts of the foreign kings. We see things starting to happen. And it's like a final statement to us that God is still in charge. So I come with these three concluding statements, okay? I'm going to fade in and out only three times on this conclusion. And here's what I see. And I see that the consequence of disobedience is real. The consequence of disobedience is real. When I read that list, I want you to keep in mind, this is not mythology. This is not an allegory. This is not Cinderella. Okay? This is not the boy who cried wolf. This is an actual story. These are the numbers of people. This is the chronology. This is the chronicles, if you would, of what happened. These names that are here, at times people would say, oh, is the Bible just this, that? No, they've uncovered in Babylon historical and ancient documents that refer to these incidents. These are historical documents that tell us about an event that happened. These are real people that got carried away into exile. These are real numbers. Someone actually took time to sketch them out. They weren't like cavemen, bang, bang, carry them off. This was Nebuzaradan, cart it off, get the secretary over, what's your name, write it down, what's your name, write it down, get a list, how many people, 3,043, okay, you're going to Babylon. When they got to Babylon, they checked, did all 3,043 make you here, yes, check, check, okay. Like, I mean, they are efficient, organized people. These are real events. And one of the issues with Jeremiah is the people keep thinking it's not real. It won't really happen. It did happen. That's the numbers. That's how many went away. That's what happened. The consequence of disobedience is very real. It reminds me of this. For us in our day, maybe this is difficult to appreciate because we live in the age of grace. It seems like we are safe from our disobedience, right? We're completely forgiven by God. And we sing songs about innocence renewed and the sin atoned for and things like that. So we can sometimes look and get a feeling to ourselves that consequences don't matter to us because we're Christians in the New Testament. We are followers of Christ and we don't have to worry about that kind of thing. But I don't think it's as simple as that. If you look over to Galatians chapter 6, in the New Testament, Paul is talking about attitudes that are needing to be dealt with. And he says now this is not just to Christians. This is to people who were leaders in the church, but they weren't wanting to follow Christ's way. They were people that thought they knew better than Paul, and they knew better than Peter, and they knew better than the apostles, and they could do a better job in Christianity than these guys did. And so, you know, these are people in the church, but they're being misguided. And Paul says to them, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Have you ever heard that before? Have you ever heard that quoted? You know, hey, do not be deceived. God will not be mocked. Right? And we sometimes not sure how to apply that. And like I said, in a day and an age of grace where sin is always atoned for and we can receive forgiveness, we wonder what this means. But nonetheless, in the New Testament, we are warned, do not be deceived. God cannot be mocked. A man reaps what he sows. Whoever sows to please their flesh, from the flesh will reap destruction. Whoever sows to please the Spirit, from the Spirit will reap eternal life. So there is a warning here. Much like Jeremiah, in his day, there is this New Testament word which comes to us in our day of grace that says, pay attention to your ways. Because consequences for sin and disobedience are real. Now, it may be that this may not affect your entrance into heaven. It may be that when you come to heaven, that God says, you claim the blood of Christ, therefore you're saved. I get that. I don't want to go to that place where, at times where we felt like if you ever did anything wrong, you had to repent before Jesus came back and you'd be stuck. You know, you would never go to the theater because what if Jesus came back and you're in the middle of the theater, you know, or the bowling lanes or something, you know, like sinful things. when I was a kid, there were sinful things. There were, and that was your concern, that you couldn't get through the roof of the movie theater. The rapture would come and everyone else would go. And very real concerns, right? And we move away from that. And we remember guys like Calvin and others who say you cannot be unsaved. You are in Christ. You cannot be lost. God will hold you, and you will, you know, you can do whatever you want. You're still going to make it into heaven. And we react against that. But somewhere in the middle of this, somewhere in the tension of this, is the reality that yes, you are secure in Christ. But yes, you better pay attention to your life, because there are consequences to disobedience, and they are real. They are real. It isn't always that God is angry at you. Even in Jeremiah, God loved his people, loved them deeply. But he said, I have to acknowledge this. And you parents, you know this, because you've done this to your kids. You've said, if you continue to do that, I'm taking away your iPad. If you continue to do this, you're going to lose your internet privileges. Or you teenagers, you're going to lose your cell phone, you know. You had consequences. And they did it, and you took it away, and they cried, they screamed, you hate me, and you say, no, I don't hate you, but I told you, it's gone, see you later, you know? And you held to that, because you're loving, but you said, there are consequences to your behavior. In fact, it's so beautiful, parents, that you do it. Think about it. You doing that with your kids is setting them up to understand the greater thing, which is a relationship with God, where there are consequences. That's a greater thing. And so you're training your kids in spiritual matters when you do that. Because you're helping them to understand there are consequences to disobedience, and they are real. Okay? My second conclusion, fade out of that one, fades in, and it leads into it. The key to our prosperity is our obedience. Okay? The key to our prosperity is our obedience. Let me just show you. In Jeremiah, there's a couple of little summary things that happened throughout. In chapter 45, in the midst of all his prophecies, it's sort of at the end of the whole story, the conquest of Jerusalem. But Jeremiah's had a faithful secretary. Okay? He's had a secretary, an executive assistant, if you will, who's been with him for his entire ministry. His name is Baruch. And Baruch scribed and wrote all these things, and when the scrolls got burned, he sat down and had to write them all out again. And so Baruch is a very important person in Jeremiah's life. He's his executive assistant. He's a strong member, but at times maybe he was testy, but in the end, Jeremiah says to him, listen, you've been loyal, and I want you to know this. All this garbage that you've been writing down that's going to happen, because you have been loyal, God is going to bless you. God is going to protect you. You know, and he's like, wow, you just be obedient and God will bless you. Then there was another story. It was in chapter 35. That's why Jeremiah takes some. It's a prophetic activity, is what he did. He took the Rechabites. Rechabites were like a sect. They were a division. You know, it'd be like you and I, we would say there are Mennonites, or there are Amish Mennonites, or something like that. Well, this is a group of people that were a little bit different than the usual Jews, and their ancestor had given them a pledge that they would not drink wine, they would not drink alcohol, and he had some stipulations. And this group of people were very committed to this practice. And generations later, here they are, still committed to their ancestors, committed to the way that their father, Rechab, had given to them. And Jeremiah gets them, and he brings them over to the temple, and he says, guys, come here. He brings a whole bunch of them, he brings them over, and he says, come here, look at this. And he pulls out all this wine, and he says, look at this wine. I want you to have it. I want you to have it. You know, and he's a famous person. This is Jeremiah. It's not just some local guy. This is Jeremiah. Going, come on, have some wine, right? I know what it's like. I was in Italy, and the pastor there had to say, have you tried my limoncello? It's the best limoncello around. And I had to drink wine, you know, and he said, come on, have my limoncello. And I go, burned my throat. Like, thank you. It was beautiful. Why is something that burns your throat good? I don't know, but it was like, oh, the best. So I'm like, I felt a little pressure, and this guy will offend him, whatever. Jeremiah's, come on, Herschel. And they said, no, our father pledged to us that he would do this, and we hold to that. And he made that a sermon, and he went up and told people, he said, listen, these Rechabites held true to what their father had laid down for them. And he goes, and you guys will not be obedient to what your father's laid out to us. So these Rechabites, and he said to them, all this garbage that's going to happen, I want you to know this. Because of your obedience and your faithfulness, you are going to be spared. You are going to be looked after. God is going to take care of you. Wow. This is the kind of, these are the little things that happened in the story of Jeremiah. And there was one last one, and it was Ebed-Melech, one of the leaders in the city of Jerusalem. Ebed-Melech was, I don't know, I mean, Jeremiah obviously had some fans. He had people that liked him. And when he got opposed one time and thrown into a cistern, and they were going to kill him, they didn't want to kill him personally because they would get, you know, blood on their hands, and they didn't want that. So they put him in a cistern, which is a big tank for water in the ground where they store water. And the ground is muddy, just mud. And Jeremiah is literally dropped in there. He's in this dark hole in the mud. He's not going to last long. He's laying in there. And some guys go to Ebed-Melech and say, listen, we can't leave Jeremiah there. We got to do something. So Ebed-Melech, despite the opposition I'm sure that he would have had, got his men, and they went over there. They lowered some ropes. They even got some clothes and made it more comfortable because maybe he was frail. So he said, wrap these clothes here and put the rope and then lift you up. And they got him out of the cistern, cleaned him up, and he stayed with them. And they weren't too happy. Others weren't happy about it. But Ebed-Melech basically said, this is not the way to treat a man. Later on, as the trouble's happening, the city is being threatened, Jeremiah goes to Ebed-Melech and says, God wants you to know this. Because you are good to me, because you are faithful, because you are obedient, you're going to be spared. All of this garbage is going to happen, you're going to be spared. And you see that in Jeremiah, and I think it's a reminder to us that our obedience is the key to prosperity, right? We can't demand it of God, but God pays attention to our obedience, right? Just as he does our disobedience, but he pays attention to our obedience. And when we're faithful, we just say, Lord, I'm going to just be faithful. God sees it, and he cares to you about what you're going to do. And don't look around. Don't look around at other people. I love the story in John 21 when Jesus challenges Peter. It's after he's resurrected and before he's ascended, and he's talking to him, and he says, Peter, Peter, you love me? He says, yeah, I love you. You love me? Yes, I love you. He says, okay, feed my sheep. Feed my sheep. This is what I want you to do. Just be obedient to me. And he goes, one day, people are going to have to look after you and serve you because you're going to be in a bad way. And they all thought he's talking about how Peter's going to die. And Peter's like, oh, it's going to be not a great ending. But he says, it might not be pleasant, but just be faithful. Feed my sheep. And Peter goes, what about him? And he points to John. What about him? And Jesus goes, what about him? If I want him to be alive till I come back, then that's my business, not yours. You, I just said, feed my sheep. Stop worrying about him. You just be faithful to what you've got. And that's always kind of a reminder that we get, that you're not trying to be faithful to what someone else is called to do. Just be faithful to who you are. Be faithful to what God's put in front of you. Just be obedient to him. Just follow Jesus. And as you will be obedient to him, he is going to bless you. He is going to look after you. And the last thing of the conclusion is the power of God to produce good in the midst of horrible circumstances is astounding. The power of God to produce good in the midst of horrible circumstances is astounding. Okay? The book ends, and that's the book ends with those words. Jehoiakim is in prison by the king, and guess what happens? He gets brought out, and he gets to sit at the table of the king in Babylon, and he is receiving mercy, and he's being treated with respect and treated well. And you say, well, how can that be? In the midst of all this, he gets treated well. That's just the grace of God. And that's kind of what happened to numerous people. In fact, those people that went into exile flourished. They flourished. Ezra says 46,000 came back. Okay? 46,000 came back out of captivity. So they prospered and multiplied in that land and came back on fire for God. In fact, dedicated, we will not be like our ancestors. We will be obedient to God. That became the driving passion of the new people that came back out of exile. They learned that they had to trust God. And there in the midst of Babylon, they flourished. They were looked after. when Esther was there in the palace and Mordecai, her uncle, was there and they tried to wipe out all the Jews, Mordecai and Esther concocted this plan and they went and they received favor and the enemy was overturned and they were blessed. Daniel was risen to the highest place in the land and the three Hebrew children were given high seats of authority in the government and the kings blessed them. And even when Cyrus the Persian king beat the Babylonians and they got their end, their comeuppance, as we would say, the Persians came in and Cyrus, the king of Persia, said, I want to send you guys back to your land. Not only send you back, but I want you to take back every single treasure that was stolen from you. And here's some money to go and build a new temple. And here's some money. And then Nehemiah came and said, here's some money. Go build that wall. Go restart your city. Go do this. And they got all this blessing and everything. And you think, how is this possible? You know, only God can take horrible circumstances and say, watch what I can do. Watch what I can do.
Yeah.
You know, and I just want to encourage us that in the midst of horrible circumstances, we must keep our eyes attentive to the work of God, because even when he's bringing judgment against Jerusalem and sending the Babylonian army in to get them, in the same moment, he's doing renewal and he's doing something good in the hearts of people and he's bringing out plans to prosper them. We talked about last week, plans to bless them, to not do them harm. So God is about to do great things in the midst of it. In the end, the conclusion keeps coming back. God wins. God wins. I'm going to invite the team to come back and we'll close with a song. And as we close with this song, I would just invite you to just reflect on the reality that God wins. That you can't... You can't do a maneuver around God. You don't need to form alliances with Egypt and try to find a way to beat Nebuchadnezzar and the spiritual allegory of what that might be in your life. Okay? You can't miss out. God will prevail. So what are you going to do? I think you're going to look and say, where in my life am I showing that I am going to be obedient and dependent on God? Where in my life am I showing that I'm not depending on God? Where in my life am I showing that it's more about me figuring out my own way to prosperity than it is to trust in God? And even if you say, well, yeah, well, I've got good investments and I'm good with my money, that's good. That's still not your solution. You still have to take that and say, God, I will do my best, but here, I need to trust you. Take this dollar and bless it. You bring it to God.